Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.
Greetings to all of you listening around the world, and a warm welcome as we bring you another edition of the Answers for the Family radio show. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and if you're a regular listener, thank you for joining us once again. And if this is your first time, please make yourself at home as we bring you Answers for the Family. Each week, this show will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more. Now, having over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, I've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields and skilled authors who are all working to make this world a better place for all of us. Now, today, I'm operating solo, but please check out some of our past shows at answersforthefamily.com to hear some informative and entertaining guests, as well as some dynamic co-hosts. Now, I'm also looking for some show ambassadors who will forward at least one of our shows to your social media group and or to someone you know that can benefit from a particular show. Now, I truly appreciate it, and this is just another way we can all make a positive difference in the lives of others. Now, we have a very interesting topic today. Now, my question to those of you listening is, does your family suffer from affluenza exhaustion? Are you confused by the me, me, me attitude of your children? Now, whether your child is 6, 16, or 36 years old, it may be time for an entitlement intervention. And as much as you may think it's the other way around, you must change yourself to change your children. Now, our topic today is Earn It. What to do when your child needs an entitlement intervention. To discuss this, our guest, Dr. Michael G. Wetter, is a diplomat and fellow of the American Psychotherapy Association and an active member of the American Psychological Association, the American Academy of Psychologists, the National Alliance of Psychology Providers, and the California Psychological Association. Dr. Wetter is a nationally recognized expert in the field of psychology, a published author, and a sought-after speaker and guest lecturer for training other psychologists and mental health professionals. He has served as an expert consultant on numerous television programs as well as publications such as The Washington Post, The Boston Globe, Forbes Magazine, Prevention Magazine, and Red Book Magazine, just to name a few. His research in the field of anxiety has been accepted in the United States Memorial Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., and his theories on the subject of anxiety transmission have been published extensively. Dr. Wetter, thank you so much for joining us on Answers for the Family.
That's an honor and a privilege.
Well, it is great to have you. I had a chance to go through your book, and I think you really touch on some very important things. And one of the things that I liked was the 10 questions. You had a 10-question quiz that determines how entitled my child is. So, and I liked it so much that what I want to do is I want to really start out by asking those questions so that our listeners can learn just how entitled their children are and why. And for those listeners out there, if you determine that your child is overly entitled, I strongly suggest that you get the book to learn how to create a family culture where responsibilities are honored, praise has meaning, decisions are made skillfully, and gratitude is second nature.
I love that. That's a great idea. Let's do it.
All right. So one of the first question is, my daughter's 10th birthday party is beginning to cost more than our wedding. How do I pull back and explain to her this can't happen?
You know, that scenario emerged actually from my real life experience. And it was actually To make matters worse, it was actually my daughter's fourth birthday, and it did cost more than my wedding. To be fair, my wife and I eloped, so let's put it in some perspective. But that being said, what can we do? There's three practical things that we all need to be made aware of, okay? And here are the three real critical key points. One, we all want our children to be happy. The trouble is we as parents sometimes go overboard, and we try to make our kids happy all the time. And this can unwittingly foster entitlement behaviors. Number two, no matter where we are as a parent, whether parenting a toddler, a tween, or a young adult, we can all relate to it. And the third key point is that whatever damage we've done as parents, it can be reversed. So when we talk about scenarios such as birthday parties, what we're really, or events of that nature, we want to explain to our children that, you know, we do want them to be happy and we do want to give them the things that they want, but at the same time, we have to balance wants with needs. And what is realistic and what can be negotiated. We want to understand their perspective, but we also want them to make sure that they understand our perspective. And just because we always want something doesn't mean we always get what we want. It's also important. In fact, it's a priority to focus on what we need.
I couldn't agree more. So how do these extravagant parties, vacations, and gifts send the wrong message to our kids and fuel more entitlement?
Well, very simply, it's because we engage in this race of keeping up with the Joneses. We're trying to demonstrate in some regards, you know, how much we love our children, how much we want them to be happy. But one aspect that plays into this is social media. We as parents will often see what other families are doing. We'll say, oh, you know, I want to do that as well. By catering to these extravagant needs at an early age, what we're modeling for our children is that, look, you know, whatever you want, the sky is the limit. And the problem with that is not that we're sending the wrong message to our children at an early age. The problem is they're going to run into a very different message later in life, which is, guess what? You don't always get what you want. Life isn't always going to roll out for you the red carpet and this extravagance. You have to be a participant in earning those things. So earn it really is about how does one cultivate resiliency in the face of adversity? How does one appreciate what they have? And how does one work towards achieving those things that they want and need? So by having these truly extravagant parties and trips and vacations that occur at a very early age without any correlation to how it was earned, to how it was brought about, and to what the consequence was, positive or negative, of doing it, without those key conversations and messages, children will just assume that life will give them what they want. And that's not exactly what we want to instill as a value in our children as they grow up.
And you know, I was just talking about this a little earlier on an earlier show, and the host of that show brought up a great point, and he said that no matter how many of these parties or things that you set up, it still doesn't replace quality time with your child. And I thought that was a great point.
Well, absolutely. And you know, and the fact of the matter is that when it comes to love, when it comes to attachment, it is indubitably quality over quantity. And I mean that in terms of entitlement isn't about affluence. It's about attitude. And I think a common misconception is, well, only rich kid or the uber wealthy kids grew up to be entitled. And that couldn't be further from the truth. The entitlement attitude comes when they're in many ways when the patients take over the insane asylum, so to speak, when the kids take over the house, and when their wants become the top priority of over everything, that's when entitlement begins. And again, it doesn't matter at what point in their lives this occurs. Intervention can make a big difference and reduce entitlement behaviors.
I couldn't agree more. And as far as the next question, this one touches on an area that I think a lot of parents will be able to relate to. And this one reads, my children share images of themselves on the internet. They may not even be aware, might have a terrible impact years from now. How do we as parents handle this?
You know, it's a really important point. And I go back to, again, the challenge and the danger of social media is that everything sticks around forever now. Mm-hmm. You know, it used to be sticks and stones would break my bones, but words would never hurt me. Now it's sticks and stones will break my bones, but social media never dies. So images that people share today can be brought about 5 years from now, 10 years from now. It can get you fired from your job. It could prevent you from getting a job. You know, your future in-laws could Google your name and pull up, you know, pictures that you may not want to see. Same with your potential spouse or mate. There are so many inherent dangers in social media that have yet to be either regulated, considered, or really discussed, that as our children are growing up now in a social media age, they need to be taught how to act responsibly, associated not only with protecting their identity, but by protecting the, if you will, the perception of their identity as well. And that's where I think parents really must act as a filter. Just like we tend to be cautious of what our children watch on TV or the books that they read or the publications they bring home, we need to be cautious and equally present in terms of how they're utilizing social media. There is no reason, in my professional opinion, that a child of 7 or 8 should have a Facebook page or an Instagram account or whatnot, even though their friends might, because you don't know what they're posting. Mm-hmm. And the same goes with someone who's 14, 15, 16. Now, they may be old enough to have the account, but do they really understand the consequence of what they post and how that will come back potentially in 5, 10 years? These are the things we have to have open and honest discussions with our children as early as possible.
Yeah, and to add to that, and one of my companies, which is an investigation company, we do backgrounds for law enforcement candidates. And one of the things that is now done is a social media search. And I can't tell you how many times we've done a social media search on an applicant that is applying for a law enforcement position, and there are pictures of them drinking while a minor or smoking marijuana, you know, and partying, and, you know, in these little short videos of them having a great time. You know, the thing is that I think that, you know, the parents, to be able to sit down with them and go, okay, look, you were 18 or 17 when you put this on there. When you apply for a job, is this something that you want your employer to consider when they have, you know, hundreds of thousands of other people applying for that same position?
Absolutely. It's so critical to have those conversations because, let's face it, you know, especially teens, they don't necessarily believe it. They say, oh, you're being overprotective. Oh, you're being ridiculous. Nobody's going to care. You know, it used to be where, you know, if you were out at a party and somebody took a Polaroid of you, you know, you could either hold on to that Polaroid, it would get lost, or destroy it. That's fine. Now it's gone. Now it's just a memory. Mm-hmm. Now, like you said, anybody can pull up anything. It's not that difficult. And I think that what kids need to be made aware of, and most importantly, what parents need to be made aware of, is how damaging it can be. And how, you know, this goes back to the concept of entitlement, which is kids thinking, I'm entitled to my opinion, I'm entitled to post whatever I want. It's not just about the photos, it's also about what views are they expressing, what thoughts are they expressing. And sometimes they can post some really damaging, inadvertently damaging opinions, perceptions that they may grow out of, that they may not even understand how they're worded, but they're out there. And once they're out there to stay.
And that's a great point. And I think also right now we're in some very, you know, very difficult times, very contentious political opinions that are out there. And, you know, how can we teach our kids, you know, in an agreeable way to look at some of these things? They may agree, they may disagree, but then to post something like that, if they strongly disagree with something, and to post it out there with say a hate message, how that's something that can stay with them for a very long time.
There's a permanence in this, and I think that's what has to be kind of outlined and explained to our children. And what we're really talking about and what you're referring to is the skill, if you will, of teaching our children how to disagree effectively, and that everyone isn't certainly entitled to their opinion. How we express our opinion is a reflection of ourselves. I think that starts at the home. I think how parents express their opinion in front of their children, and how very often children and parents will disagree, how we as parents convey and model that form of communication when we disagree is incredibly important. And we talk about that in Earn It. Really, it's about making sure that each person is listening to the other perspective. And I think that's a key skill that's not often being practiced, preached, or taught, especially in social media, which is so many people are so eager and impulsive, if you will, to get their opinion out there that they're not listening. Mm-hmm. And I think there's true detriment to not listening to another side. You don't have to agree with it, but listen to it. And then be mindful of how you're responding to it, because, again, it's etched in cement.
Yeah, and that's a great point. And we have a lot of people out there now that want to demonize somebody for disagreeing, and mm-hmm. that's not healthy. You know, we need to be able to disagree. We need to be able to stand on our principles, and that's great. But you don't mm-hmm. need to demonize somebody for thinking differently.
Correct. And we want to move away from a mob mentality of destroying somebody. I think it's important to, and this goes back into the concept now of really a much grander lesson, and something we speak about quite extensively in Earn It, which is how to fail. Okay, how we teach our children to fail, and how we teach them to fail effectively, which is in some cases kind of a bizarre and strange concept for parents to hear, because the last thing we want to do is have our kids fail.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we want to preach success, but teaching our children how to fail effectively doesn't mean we're encouraging failure. It means that we are teaching them how to use failed experiences as a way to build a towards success, how to learn from our mistakes. And that comes from disagreeing, that comes from having different opinions, that comes sometimes from sticking your foot in your mouth, and sometimes it means doing something, you know, whether it's a test or whether it is a project or an attempt at something in sports. How do we learn from that? And I think sometimes we have, whether it be in politics now or even in, you know, show business, the inability for people to recognize that they've made a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't take responsibility for it. In fact, they try to scapegoat it. They'll try to duck it. They'll even ignore it. And I think that sends the wrong message. And it's not about what they're doing in politics or in the entertainment industry. What is going on at home? What is the message that parents are preaching? And that's where it starts.
Yeah, and I think I was, you know, I like most people, I was guilty of this as well, as far as, you know, trying to fix everything and keep my kids from being harmed, keep them from failing. And one of the things that I'm really proud of my oldest son is when he was about 10 years old, he came home and told me that a bully had told him that tomorrow after school, if he doesn't give him money, he's going to beat him up. Well, I immediately started to go into action. I know the principal. I'm going to contact them, and I'm going to fix this. And he just stopped and he said, "Dad, could you please not try to fix this? I can handle it." And wow. He did, and he did it. He did it in a wonderful way. It got handled. But that was just one of those times in which, you know, it. Fortunately, we'd done enough right things earlier on for him to recognize that. You know, he doesn't need to have us fix everything all the time. And, you know, and again, it's what we should be striving for, is to understand that they do have to grow and they do have to learn certain messages and certain lessons. And sometimes it's not going to be pretty.
And that's, I think that's such a wonderful example. And there are the more mundane examples as well. I'm guilty of this myself, you know, as recently as a month ago, where my daughter's, I have one daughter, her name is Leia. She's 8 years old and in the third grade. And right now they're kind of learning the concept of studying and routine homework assignments and doing those things. And one day she goes, "Well, you know, I didn't bring home my homework." And right away, my knee-jerk response is, "Well, I'm going to call the teacher. I'll call the principal. I'll find out, how do I get the assignment? Maybe they can email it to me. Maybe they can fax it to me, whatever it may be." And then I caught myself like, "Well, you know, I've been to school. I've done my homework. It's now your turn. So if you don't remember your homework at school, that's your responsibility. And that's, you're going to have to now deal with the consequence of not remembering to bring your homework." So sure enough, she didn't get her homework done. And the next day, brought her homework back, and she says, okay, so now I have my homework, and every day I'm going to check my cubby before I leave to make sure I have my homework. And that's a very mundane example, but a great way of showing, you know, a failed experience can lead to a successful learning experience and building that sense of responsibility and resiliency.
Yeah, and it's a perfect example because, again, the next day, recognizing that this is my responsibility to do it as opposed to forgetting again, but going, well, it's okay if I forget now because Dad'll fix it.
Daddy will rescue me, you know. Daddy's always, you know. And let's face it, because this is how I feel. It feels good to rescue.
Sure.
Okay. It feels good to be the hero. Who doesn't want to be the hero? Who doesn't want to be the apple of their daughter or son's eye and say, "I'm here for you, no matter what."
Mm-hmm.
But then, what happens when they're 35?
And you're not.
You know. And you're not there, or you're not able to rescue. What happens if something goes wrong at their work and they're not fulfilling their responsibilities at their job? Are you going to go in and talk to their boss and say, "Hey, look, you're not giving my kid a break"?
Yeah, that's going to go over well.
Yeah, I guarantee you, it will never go over well. And that's the whole point. It's not about, you know, making things all perfect right now. It's about giving them the tools to succeed later on. And really, this notion, and we, you know, on the cover of our book, there's actually a trophy, and it says participant.
Mm-hmm.
And this goes back to, I think, a movement that started in the late 60s, early 70s, which was more about rewarding participation than it was about the outcome.
Mm-hmm.
And this was to embody and embolden people's concept of themselves and feeling nurtured and supported. So if you showed up for a sport and you did horribly in it, you still got a trophy just as big as the person who hit a home run out of the park every game. And one of the things that I think is let's just say erroneous about that end of the spectrum of nurturing and supporting is that later on, as these kids get older, their expectations of what is rewarded is skewed.
Yep.
So, for example, again, we take somebody who's 28, 29 years old, and they're in the workforce now, and they've been working at their job for about 6 months, and they go into their boss's office and say, "You know what? I think I deserve a raise." And the boss says, "Okay, why?" "Well, because I've come to work every day, I show up on time, and I do what I'm told."
Yep.
Yes, and that's good, right? That's what I'm supposed to do. So I deserve a reward. I deserve a promotion. I deserve a raise. Like, no, you did what was expected. You haven't gone above and beyond. You haven't knocked it out of the park. You haven't demonstrated any particular extraordinary set of skills. But again, what have we been fostering here? You know, by doing what is expected or just by participating, I deserve to get rewarded. And that's not the way the world works.
Well, and I think it hurts both ends of the spectrum, because as you're saying, you know,
yes,
if it's the one that always participated but never did anything special, their expectation is they deserve something greater for what they've done. I think in the other aspect of it, the person who has strived and they have worked harder than everybody else, I think it skews their thinking when they get older, because it's like, well, I'm not getting anything anymore, so maybe I just go back.
Why bother?
Yeah, why bother? Maybe I just go back to doing, you know, the minimum amount of things to do, because I'm going to get the same reward.
Exactly, and again, I think that's an excellent point, which it does affect both ends. And, you know, again, I think the term and the group of millennials gets a bad rap, because, you know, we extend this terminology and this label that everybody born within this particular time frame is entitled and they're spoiled, and they think the world should be served up to them on a silver platter. And that's not necessarily true of all of them, but there is a degree of, if you will, a theme that comes about where, and that stemmed out of this movement of recognizing participation only and not necessarily rewarding the exceptional effort that goes in sometimes and the product that comes out of it. So we have to, I tend to look at our behavior as parents and as a society as riding along this pendulum. And, you know, we tend to swing from one extreme to another. And I think the closer we can get to that center, the better off our children and future generations will be. And that, I think that's the goal, is, you know, before the pendulum in the 70s swung one end, and now we're starting to move back. And that's really what we're trying to speak to, is how do parents move back? How can you be supportive? How can you be loving? And at the same time, how do you set limits? How do you build resiliency? How do you build in gratitude when it doesn't exist?
Well, and I think those are all great points. And as we were talking about this, it actually reminded me of a story, again, when my kids were young, and I was the room dad. And during during the recess, during one of the recesses, I was teaching the kids to play volleyball. And so I'm over there, and I'm explaining the rules, and we're going through, and I'm showing them how to bump and pass and hit the ball over the net and so on. And so we start a game, and, you know, and I go, okay, now see, this team gets a point for this and stuff. This woman who works all the time in recess runs over to me, and she starts screaming at me. She goes, what are you doing? And I go, we're playing volleyball. She goes, no. She goes, you were keeping score. What? And I got sent to the principal's office. So I was a new room parent. I got sent to the principal's office, and the principal I knew personally. So I went in there, and the principal looks at me, and it's all I can do to keep from laughing. And she says, "What's wrong?" And I said, "Well, I've been sent to you because I've been bad." I explained what happened. But, you know, that's where we've taken this too far. I mean, it's, you know, we need to be able to, you know, life keeps score. I mean,
it's true. And I think I remember when my daughter was like 4 years old, we used to play Candyland. Okay. And truth be told, I love seeing her win.
Sure.
There was nothing like it. Okay, that satisfaction on her face, that pure joy of victory was wonderful. And sometimes I fully admit it. Sometimes I would stack the cards so I knew she would get, you know, the spaces ahead, so she could get to the candy castle first. And I wanted to do that. But as we continued to play, and as she grew more confident, I also made sure that I would beat her.
Sometimes
I would also make sure that she would lose from time to time, and it wasn't so that I can say, now, you know, I want to win. It wasn't a competition. It was to be able to teach her, this is what it's like when you don't win. Mm-hmm. This is what it's like when you don't get the victory that you were expecting or used to. How are you going to deal with it? Being an effective and gracious loser is just as important as being a gracious and effective winner.
And it also makes victory a little sweeter.
It does, because then you've earned it, haven't you?
Yeah, exactly. So, well, let me go in, and I know we were talking about school for a little bit, but to go into another one of the questions that, again, is from the book, and again, for those parents out there, you can get the book, and you can go through these questions, and it will help you really look at your own family structure and wonder, do you need, you know, a entitlement intervention? But this question is, if my son or daughter isn't performing well in school, how can I talk to him or her without being angry or showing disappointment?
Yeah, and that's a big one. And let's face it, whenever our children, no matter what age they are, don't doing well in school, it feels like a reflection on us as parents. And we don't want to see them struggle. We don't want to see them fail. At the same time, part of what we need to do is understand, why are they struggling? Is this because it's a lack of effort? Is it because it's a lack of ability? Is there a learning disorder? Is there something going on emotionally? So I think it all starts with the conversation. One of the things that we need to practice and learn as parents is not to make assumptions of our children's behavior. Really to sit down and talk with them and say, so, you know, here's what your grade was on this test, or here's what your, you know, end semester grades were. I want to talk about this because it's not that I'm disappointed, it's not that I'm angry, but I am concerned. And it's my job, it's my responsibility as a parent to be concerned when you may be struggling. So let's talk about this. Is there something going on? How can we be of assistance? How can I help you become more confident and not have to struggle with this as much? And, you know, I think it's less about how do we fix the problem, but starting with how do we identify, is there a problem? And that's where it starts. And then having this continued conversation of finding out what works. You'd be amazed what parents will learn when you actually ask your child for their perspective. And it doesn't matter if they're 6 or 16, they have a perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So starting with that conversation is the first step. That way you dismiss this perception that they may have that you're angry or that they're in trouble. If they get bad grades and because they've been slacking off or they're not participating, they're not doing their homework, rather than saying, I'm angry at you and you're lazy and using this various, you know, tones of voice or say, there's a consequence that comes with this. Outline what the consequences are, you know, making it very clear. These are not my grades. These are your grades. This is what follows you. Okay. This is your currency as an academic, as a student. Grades are your currency. This is what it's going to speak to you. And this is what's going to define your perception, whether you go to college or other teachers. This is what they're going to think of you. How do you want that to look? Mm-hmm. How does it feel? Because if you feel beaten down, if you feel that you don't like this, if you feel that you're not doing well, let's address that. How do we embody that? How do we embolden that within you? And I think that's where it starts.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think just, you know, to ask them the question, because many times they're going to know if they were doing their best or not. So just asking that question alone, you know, do you feel that, you know, that you gave it your absolute best to get this? And if you've got the right relationship with your child, you're probably going to get a pretty honest answer.
Yeah. And again, and that's our challenge as parents, you know, as we talk about identifying entitlement and what's going on with our kids, really the first and primary step is figuring out what are we doing as parents? Because we set the standard. We are merely the models for our kids, and our kids will mirror back what they get from us. So if we don't set the appropriate model, if we set the wrong tone, it's going to be reflected back from our children. So if we are coming across as impulsive, if we're coming across as non-understanding or not willing to engage in discussion or having an open mind, guess what? Neither will they.
Absolutely. Okay, we're going to take a break now, but for everybody out there, if you're sitting at your computer and you want to open up another window, you can go to www.drwetter.com. That's W-E-T-T-E-R. You can follow along with us, and we're going to take a break. Remember, the book is Earn It, What to Do When Your Child Needs an Entitlement Intervention. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Founded over 30 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield has continually focused on resolving issues that negatively impact families and businesses. Our signature therapeutic transportation service helps to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely transported to specialized schools, programs, and treatment centers with unsurpassed experience and success. We are supported by our full-service, licensed investigation agency that has legally, professionally, and compassionately located hundreds of runaways and teens. We are experienced and qualified to help, offering solutions which may include referrals to our international network of top professionals in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, psychiatry, and investigations. Simply put, Westshield Adolescent Services and Westshield Investigations are the best solutions when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's 1-800-899-8585, or visit our website at westshield.com. Thank you.
And we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family, and our topic is entitlement. So one of the questions that is in the book really talks about the idea of appreciating the things that they do have, which is obviously a big issue when it comes to entitlement. So one of the questions is, my children don't take care of their things, toys, iPhones, and clothes. They take everything we get them for granted. Do we take them away? Do we refuse to buy more items? How can we deal with their complete disregard or lack of gratitude for the things they have?
Well, and again, another really important question, and one that comes up a tremendous amount of time, no matter what age. And I think the first step is having that conversation with the children by analyzing our own behavior. Have we been giving them too many things? Have we tied the behavior of giving with what they've had to do to earn something? You know, in today's world, the purchasing of iPads and iPhones and tablets and PlayStations and all these other various tech, or what some people will refer to as entertainment or toys, we're talking about thousands and thousands of dollars that kids, once they get it, it's like it's the coolest thing, and then 3 days later have no appreciation for it, nor do they have the appreciation for how much it cost, how much you had to work for it, or, you know, even how to use it effectively. So I think it starts with the conversation. When someone says, I want a PlayStation, it's perfectly fine to say, yeah, that's a great thing. So what are we going to do about that? How, you know, a PlayStation costs X number of dollars. What are you going to do to earn that? And I think by having that conversation, you establish the fact that, you know, wants are not freely entertained and met with, okay, we'll get it for you. Because that does foster entitlement. If all they have to do is say, I want it, and you get it, there we go. How is life going to deal that later on? Yep. It's not going to work out that way. So I think it starts with that. The other thing is what if they're already demonstrating this? Because remember what I said before, it doesn't matter what age, it doesn't matter what point, there's always ways to intervene and reverse the damage that's been done. And again, I think that's a conversation. It's sitting them down and saying, you know what? One of the things that we're seeing as your parents is that you don't seem to appreciate what you have. And that's concerning to us. It's not about talking about spoiled. It's not talking about bad kids. It's about saying, it really comes down to you needing to learn how to appreciate the wonderful things that you have. So before we get anything else, before we entertain buying something new or whatever, here's one practical strategy. What we want to do is we want you to go to your room and we want you to pick out 10 things. And the 10 things that, you know, you no longer play with or no longer like or whatever it may be, and we're gonna find a charity that you're gonna give those to. And before we even talk about the idea of getting something new, you have to give to somebody else first.
I like that.
And that's not a promise that you're going to get something new, but it's about what goes into the fact that you have things that you don't appreciate. Now you've got to learn and take stock and really put a value on the things that you have. And then it's a continued conversation. If I can share a recent example with you, in fact, my attempt that kind of backfired on me. not too long ago, my daughter Leia came home from school, and she was talking with her friends. Again, remember, they're 8 years old. And she goes, Daddy, you know, I want to, there's these, I don't know what they're called, creatures, Hatchimals or something like that, little ones, not the Christmas craze of last year. She goes, I really want those because my friend brought it to school and they look really cool. And I'm like, okay. And so before I even knew it, my phone was out, Amazon.com, I'm looking for it, okay? I can see it, $5.99. I belong to Prime. Here's a plug for Prime. I can get it delivered to my door without breaking a sweat by tomorrow. Before I even realize it that I'm doing it, it's already in process. So I stop. Mm-hmm. I stop and I say, okay, what are you going to do to earn that, right? I'm an expert. That's my intervention, right? I'm practicing now what I preach. What are you going to do to earn it? And she looks up at me very sincerely, very calmly. She goes, I know, Dad, I know. I got to study hard. I got to clean my room and I'll earn it. And I'm like, wait a minute. And I told her, I said, no. I said, you got to do that anyway. That's not deserving of something different and special. I said, that's not it at all. She goes, oh, and looks to me like I just changed the rules of the game. Mm-hmm. And it crystallizes the importance of being mindful and being present-centered and aware of what we do and what we say and how we communicate to our kids and how so often we get into this rut of saying, how are you going to earn it? And they know exactly what to say back. Mm-hmm. I know, do well at school, keep my room clean, yada, yada, yada. And really, it's now about establishing a new sort of understanding. Like, how are you going to appreciate these toys? What are you going to do? What are you going to give back to the community? It's not just about doing what you're supposed to do. It goes back again to that example of someone who's at work saying, I show up for work, so now I deserve something extra. Where's my bonus?
Yep.
So we really need to start at a very early age, not just defining the value of things, but the gratitude that it comes with getting it, owning it, taking pride of it. If you, you know, and I'll tell my daughter myself, if you're not taking care of it, if I find it on the floor, if you're not playing with it, I'm going to get rid of it. I'm not going to ask you for it. I'm going to get rid of it by meaning I'm not going to put it in the trash. I'm going to donate it to charity for someone who's really going to love it.
And will appreciate it. Yep.
And they'll appreciate it.
Yeah, I like it.
And that's the conversation.
Yeah, and I think another issue, and it's one of the ones that I dealt with one of my sons, but it's the difference between the word want and the word need. So we're out shopping for new tennis shoes for school, and there's a name brand that is $100. And it's, I need these tennis shoes. I really need these tennis shoes. And so I looked around the store, and I found what looked like the exact same tennis shoes without the brand on it that was $55. And so I went over and I showed him that one. And I said, look, these are just like it. They seem to be the same and so on. He goes, no, I need those other shoes. And I go, no, you need these shoes. You want those other shoes. So what I see here is you need another $45 to have what you want.
I had the same conversation except it was with my wife.
Oh, okay.
And ironically, it was about shoes too. So, you know, it goes to reinforce that it happens at every age and it happens to everybody. I think you're highlighting such an important concept, which is being able to differentiate between wants and needs. Mm-hmm. You know, and like for myself, it's I'm a big movie nut. I love movies, and there's no movie I love more than Star Wars. Okay, I to all your listeners out there, I challenge you to a Star Wars duel of trivia, of fandom, whatever it may be. But in any event, there could be a poster, an artifact that comes out, some kind of collectible, and I'll see it. I'm like, oh my God, I need to have that. And I literally have to stop myself and say, no. You really, really want it, but you don't need it. What you need to do is you need to pay the mortgage.
Yep.
You know, you need to buy the food. You need to pay for clothes. You need to pay for school supplies. You need to, you know, pay your taxes. Those are the things you need to do. So if you get to do all those things and you still have stuff and money left over, then you get to indulge in your wants.
Great point. Great point.
And that's what we want to model for our kids as well.
Mm-hmm. We've got a listener question that has come in. This one reads, I have been watching my friends who have teenagers literally walk on eggshells and jump to take care of whatever their kids demand next, just to keep them from throwing temper tantrums or doing some kind of depression act, which is in quotes. These are not bad kids, but they are totally entitled. Expert at using emotional triggers to keep their parents in line. It worries me that this appears to become the norm in some middle and upper school, some middle and upper class families. I am planning to read your book, but honestly, isn't it too late for parents and teens to make changes like this, who are so entrenched in their patterns of behavior? And this is from Joan in New York City.
Joan, thank you for the question. It's a great question. And no, it's not too late. Is it a little bit more in-depth? Is it a little bit harder and more challenging? Yes. When's it easier to learn the piano? When you're 7 or 17 or 47? Always when we're younger and the brain is a bit more plastic and more open to learning new things. So granted, it may take more effort and it may be a little harder to do at a later age, but it's never too late. And again, one of the first things that, you know, comes to my mind when you use a very eloquent term, you know, emotional triggers. Let's strip away the facts. They're being manipulative, and it's a manipulative tactic. And whether it's the threat of, oh my God, I'm gonna hurt myself, or I'm gonna be depressed. Part of our job as parents is to certainly ensure the safety of our and the well-being of our children, but that doesn't mean catering to every whim and giving in to every manipulation. So if our children are going to have temper tantrums, let them have temper tantrums. Okay, I'm not going to let them run out in the middle of the street in front of a car, but if they're going to cry in the middle of, you know, of a shopping center, so be it. Go ahead. You can cry. I'm a big man. I can take it. Being able to withstand their distress is incredibly important as a parent, because if you can't tolerate their distress, how are they going to learn to tolerate distress? And if they find that being manipulative is the only way to get their needs met, guess what? It perpetuates. So I absolutely agree with Joan's assessment that this is a continuing phenomenon. And I would make the argument it's not just in the upper and middle class, but even across all classes, across all strata, socioeconomic strata. Manipulation is a behavior that kids will learn in order to get their needs met. But again, kids can't differentiate at an early age wants and needs. So the first step, and we really do outline this in earnest, is what are the conversations you have to have? How do you introduce it? And again, even as a parent acknowledging, you know what? I've made mistakes. Remember we talked about before, failing effectively. It's perfectly fine as a parent to say, this is how I failed. This is how I've been wrong. I've been catering to you in too many ways, and it's going to stop right here, right now. I don't like that. I'm going to leave. Okay. Okay. Where are you going to go? What are you going to do? You know, this brings back to in my mind a very clear memory in my childhood where I remember something was going on at home, and I didn't like the way my mother was responding to me. She wasn't giving in to my demands. And I said that, and I think I was about 8 or 9. And I said, that's it. I'm running away from home. This shouldn't be a unique story. I'm sure others can relate to this in some way. I said, all right, that's it. I'm running away from home. And I got out this little suitcase, and I think I put in there my favorite toy, like one shirt and one shoe, because I couldn't find the other one in time. And I zipped up my suitcase, and I went down the driveway, and I sat there. And I was waiting for my mom to come down and get me, and she didn't come. Mm-hmm. She didn't come. And so it wasn't like, where was I going to go? There was no Uber at the time, okay? And not that I would be able to order one up, but where was I going to go? And I think I sat out there probably was for maybe 45 minutes. It felt like an eternity. And finally, I came up with my suitcase between my legs kind of thing. And, you know, and she goes, well, get washed up and get ready for dinner. It was one of those moments that stand out for me now, even 40-some-odd years later, because she didn't give in to my demands or needs as a child. It was, do what you're going to do. We have to ensure, now if somebody is saying, I'm deathly suicidal, and I'm going to take this to the extreme, even though it wasn't referenced in the question, I'm suicidal, the response isn't, okay, we'll do whatever you say. It's, okay, I'm going to take you to the emergency room.
Right.
That's I'm going to call the police. Mm-hmm. These are the consequences of the actions you're taking.
Yep. No, I absolutely agree. I'm looking up where we're running short of time. There was a comment that also came in. This came in through email, and again, we appreciate the people that take the time to do these. This one says, as a psychologist with 30 years of experience working with families, this very issue keeps my practice growing. After reading your book last weekend, I was so thrilled to find a piece I can hand to my clients that they so closely can use as a companion piece that reinforces my own recommendations. Thank you for the great read and a great resource. And this is from John G.
Oh, that's very kind. And I'm hearing more about this. One of the things I take great pride in is Earn It has earned a spot as a number one new bestseller on Amazon in the area of parenting. And why that gives me such great pride is not just because, oh, it's selling well on Amazon. It's because it's reaching an audience. And I think there's a definite need, whether it be as a resource for psychologists and therapists to give to the families they're working with, or just any parent. I'm telling you, this idea was born out of my own experiences as a parent and not wanting my daughter to be raised to expect things to just happen for her. And it really, you know, the examples in the book come from real life. And like I said, we're all parents. We can all relate to it. And it's never too late.
Well, and it doesn't surprise me at all that it's selling well, because I think it's something that, you know, as you said in the beginning, it's not something that just the affluent have. It's something that I think any of us in, you know, raised in a Western civilization has had a tendency to do at some level. So, Michael, I just want to thank you. I want to thank you for the book, for putting it out there. I want to thank you for coming on, and just really want everybody to know that this is something that we can all benefit from. So again, the book's name is Earn It: What to Do When Your Child Needs an Entitlement Intervention. So Dr. Michael Wetter, thank you so much for coming on Answers for the Family and sharing this with us.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
All right. And for everybody out there, please be sure to put it on your calendar to tune in next Monday when we are joined by Louisa Robb and Ann Montgomery, who will discuss how the Independent Educational Consultants Association and its foundation are helping families of all walks of life. And please visit our archives of past interviews at answersforthefamily.com, or subscribe to our to us through iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, Vimeo, or however it is that you choose to listen. And if you like what you hear, please leave a review. It will help us reach more people and be greatly appreciated. And the next time you're on Facebook or Twitter, please remember to stop by our page, check out some of our latest posts, and if you like them, please like us and spread the word. Thank you for listening. Be good human beings, and be with us again next week on Answers for the Family.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.